Blog Talk Radio.
I am the nation. I was born on July 4th, 1776, and the Declaration of Independence is my birth certificate. The bloodlines of the world run in my veins because I offered freedom to the oppressed. I am many things and many people. I am the nation. I am 200 million living souls and the ghost of millions who have lived and died for me. I am Nathan Hale and Paul Revere. I stood at Lexington and fired the shot heard round the world. I'm Washington, Jefferson, Patrick Henry. I'm John Paul Jones, the Green Mountain Boys, and Davy Crockett. I'm Lee and Abe Lincoln. I remember the Alamo, the Maine, and Pearl Harbor. When freedom called, I answered and stayed until it was over there. I left my heroic dead in Flanders Fields and in the steaming jungles of Vietnam. I am the Brooklyn Bridge, the wheatlands of Kansas, and the granite hills of Vermont. I am the coal fields of the Virginias and Pennsylvania, the fertile lands of the West, the Golden Gate and Grand Canyon. I sprawl from the Atlantic to the Pacific. 3 million square miles. I'm more than 3 million farms. I'm forest, field, mountain, and desert. I'm quiet villages, and I'm cities that never sleep. You can look at me and see Ben Franklin walking down the streets of Philadelphia. I'm Babe Ruth in the World Series. I'm 130,000 schools and colleges and 326,000 churches where my people worship God as they please. I'm a ballot dropped in a box. I am an editorial in a newspaper, and I'm a letter to a congressman. I'm Thomas Edison, Albert Einstein. I'm Horace Greeley, Will Rogers, and the Wright brothers. I'm George Washington Carver, Daniel Webster, and Jonas Salk. I'm Walt Whitman, Thomas Paine, Tom Sawyer, and Walt Disney. Yes, I am the nation, and these are the things that I am. I was conceived in freedom, and God willing, in freedom I'll spend the rest of my days. May I possess always the integrity, the courage, and the strength to keep myself unshackled, to remain a citadel of freedom and a beacon of hope to the entire world. I am the nation.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Patriot Education. My name is Carrie Rowland. I'm your hostess for this evening. And as always, we are brought to you through the good offices of PatriotFamilies.com, a collection of people who believe that they are the nation. And as the nation, they must stand up for what is right. Our topic tonight, ladies and gentlemen, is education and the work ethic. It used to be, long ago when I was a child, that we were taught and lived by the cultural understanding of the work ethic, meaning that work, doing something positive or remunerative, was the responsibility of every citizen. That doing a job, whether it was a household chore when we were small, or working for a living to support ourselves or our families as an adult, was built into the culture. It was expected of all of us. When people could not work, communities offered charity. Many people who could not work didn't want the charity of their community. What they wanted was the chance to become able to work again. Because in our culture, one was what one did. In effect, if you were a working man or a working woman, you had pride in your ability to pay your own way, to succeed or fail by your own efforts, to be compensated for your expertise, your skills, your presence, and your hard work, fairly, but not excessively. The whole point of the work ethic, which goes all the way back to the famous first settlers in the Northeast, the Pilgrims, the Protestant work ethic, if you will, is part and parcel of most of the teaching in the various denominations of Christianity that call themselves Protestant. The idea that man is put on this earth to labor, and that through his labor He makes the earth fruitful and thus pleases God. Whether or not you believe in the literal truth of biblical pronouncements, the general idea of working, putting forth effort for those things you want, has been a part of our nation since before it was a nation. Our founding fathers believed and created a framework for our government in this work ethic. They wanted the work ethic, the idea of a meritocracy, the idea of earning your way and being as successful as you possibly could through your own effort, was part of what was going to make a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, as Lincoln mentioned in the Gettysburg Address. Citizens who did not contribute to the society would not be effective at choosing leaders who would make the society free, equitable, and lasting. It was understood that every man, and in those days, man didn't just mean the masculine pronoun. They were not terribly concerned about being politically correct. But every person was expected to do work of some sort. If you were a woman, your work was in the home. And it was not considered to be degrading or useless or worthless. It was considered to be the natural part of being a homemaker, literally, the maker of a home, the one who kept things clean, who fed the family, who baked the bread, who washed the clothes, who tended the small garden for the fresh vegetables, whatever. It was an honorable thing to do the work of your home. If you were wealthy, you could afford to hire servants to do that work, but you were still responsible for directing them and making sure that they did their work well. So even in those terribly politically incorrect days when women weren't allowed to be CEOs or members of ruling bodies or public officials or anything else, it was still a work ethic, and it was a lot harder work than most women could imagine today. If I had to do the kind of work that my great-grandmother did, she died at the age of 75 from gangrene, which developed in her foot when she was out chopping firewood with her hatchet. She missed the wood and cut her foot and didn't see a doctor rapidly enough. And yes, she had to chop firewood. And she was in her late 70s, I believe, at the time. We have no understanding, ladies, of what it took to keep a house 200 years ago. Men did not have it easy then either. Work was expected of you. If you could not work, you were a drag on society. And hopefully you would find something that you could do to earn money. Otherwise, your children and your wife would have to go out and earn money somehow. Your wife by taking in other people's laundry, your children by doing errands for other people, working as farm laborers, helping out the blacksmith, whatever. But everybody understood that if you wanted something, generally you had to work for it. Our founding fathers wanted to create an educational system that would allow all people to have an equal footing as far as what they could learn that would make it possible for them to enter the workforce and make not only a living, but rise as high as their skills and abilities permitted. That was supposed to be what public education was for. Public education was supposed to be the great leveler, not leveling the playing field. The founding fathers weren't idiotic enough to assume that trying to make a living and raising a family was no more important or less important than whether or not you could play soccer on a flat ground. But a leveler in the sense that everyone would have an equal opportunity to succeed. Not equal outcomes, not be alike, but an equal chance. They did not envision a public school system that would reward mediocrity and make it the standard. They did not envision public education as a means of retraining and re-educating the population to believe whatever government told them. They did not see public education as a means to an end to accomplish a global government or a new world order. They saw it as a way to make this nation great by having informed, actively involved citizens who could read the newspapers and understand what was being said, and who could think about what they read and ask questions of their elected representatives and pay attention to the laws being enacted in state houses and in Congress, and understand the implications of those laws, and stand up and say no when the laws didn't make sense or were actively malevolent. They understood that all human beings are innately flawed. None of us is perfect. None of us is always right. None of us will ever, always, and forever make only correct choices in our lives, our work, or our relationships. Because we are human, because we are a little higher than the beasts and a little lower than the angels, we cannot be counted upon to constantly be God, ladies and gentlemen. And if we cannot be God, government certainly cannot be, because government, according to the ideas of Jefferson and peers, derives its just powers from the consent of the governed. If we consent to the assumption that government should raise our children and inculcate ideas of morality and ethics instead of us, what makes us think that government is some entity on an equal plane with the divine? Well, our public education system is doing its utmost to teach our kids that government is divine, ladies and gentlemen. That no, you don't have to work for things. It's the government's job to make sure you have them. If you ask someone, what is the government? They probably can't tell you. You will probably get an answer like, oh, it's a bunch of people in Washington, D.C. who make laws. Or they might say it's the president. Or they might say, well, it's the way the country works. But none of them are going to be able to tell you, very likely, that the government is us. We create it every time we go and vote, and every time we stay home and refuse to vote, and every time we don't pay attention to what our kids are taught in school, and every time we stay away from PTA meetings and teacher conferences and school board elections. Every time we don't pay attention, ladies and gentlemen, we consent. So the government is us, because we have allowed it to be what it is. And we are continuing to allow it because we are allowing our public education system to decline into nothing more nor less than one of Mao Zedong's re-education labor camps in the hinterlands of communist China. And I'm old enough to remember communist China in the 40s and the 50s. Oh, yes. When Mao took over, he made sure that every intellectual in the country, meaning everyone who was well-educated and understood the benefits of liberty, freedom, Western thought, anything that wasn't communist doctrine, was removed from the ability to influence or corrupt the youth, and sent away to be re-educated into happy peasants laboring in the fields. And the happy peasants who had been laboring in the fields were moved out of the fields and into sinecures, where they mouthed exactly what Mao Zedong and his ruling elite told them to. I was reading something today on a website called Education Without Representation, Citizens Against Common Core. I did not have a chance to research it, because I have not looked at all of the implications of the Common Core requirements for all of the states. But it was suggested, it was stated, that within the Common Core structure that they're trying to sell to the states in order that they can get federal funding for schools, the acceptance of Common Core also means you accept the federal government's right to reallocate and relocate teachers and principals within the school systems of your state to achieve some point of, I guess you could say, redistribution of educational wealth, in the sense that if you are a good teacher and you enjoy teaching in your school, your local school where you live, you may not be allowed to remain there if your state adopts Common Core, because Common Core may require your state's Department of Education, in order to continue to receive federal funding, to relocate you to an inner city school in which you are very likely going to be assaulted, possibly killed, definitely disrespected every classroom day, in order that your excellent teaching skills can be put where they're most needed, with the assumption that the only thing that really matters in a classroom is that the teacher be exemplary. The students have no requirements at all. If this is so, if this is a part of the strings the federal government has attached to acceptance of Common Core, you need to go out there and march around your neighborhood, and you need to talk to your city council and your county government and your state government, and you need to do everything in your power to prevent this evil measure from becoming nationwide. Because the only other recourse you have, and I would recommend this if you feel you can't march, is pull every child you know, all of your own and all of your families if you can manage it, out of public school immediately and start homeschooling or use online education, and not through the public school systems, because they're advertising that too. Because the work ethic that we understand, the idea that you put forth an effort to obtain something you want, is being trashed, ripped to shreds, and thrown away, ladies and gentlemen, because our children are being taught that government is God, and their effort is only viable when it's an effort to get something they are entitled to from government. The idea of a work ethic, the idea of putting forth effort for what you want, is the way most of us in my generation, and granted I'm old, the baby boomers you could say, were raised. Despite the craziness of the 1960s, and yes, I was around for those too, which can be partially explained by our understanding that the entire world could be destroyed by nuclear war at any given moment, which most of us believed anyway. All of that aside, we grew up with the idea that you were supposed to do something to earn things. If you were going to get a good grade, you had to work for it. If you wanted A's on your report card, you had to study. You had to pass the tests. You had to be in class. You had to do your homework. If you had difficulties at school, you told your parents, and your parents did everything they could to help you. And if they couldn't help you with it, they looked around to see if they could find somebody to tutor you, usually a retired teacher or maybe a family friend who was good at the subject, because they understood and they knew that that education was their key to becoming successful. The more you knew, the better opportunities you had when you entered the workforce. And it wasn't job training in the sense that the progressives want. It wasn't teaching your child to be a bricklayer because it was determined by looking at his genetics and doing brain scans and taking his pulse in kindergarten that would probably be what he was for, because that is pretty much an extrapolation of what the Common Core and its national database want to happen. It was teaching children the basic skills they needed to be able to read and write their native language, do mathematics, understand science, geography, history, and hopefully, know how to continue learning as long as they lived. But that work ethic, that idea that school was your job, has been downgraded to, well, if you're not having fun, it's a teacher's fault, and it should be fun all the time, because learning is fun. And the way it's interpreted by progressives means that if it isn't fun, you're obviously not learning anything, so let's fire the teacher. Learning actually is fun. Getting something new in your brain that wasn't there before, that connects to something that you knew before, and that leads you to think of something that you hadn't thought of before. That's the fun part. But the idea that everything is supposed to be given to you simply because you exist, that you are entitled to an A because you happen to show up, or because you're between the ages of 6 and 18, which is probably what they're going to do next. The whole concept of putting forth an effort to obtain something that you want or need is being undermined with every day your kids spend in classrooms where behavioral disabilities and academic disabilities and any other kind of disability you can think of have been used as an excuse to make classrooms into zoos. And I have been in classrooms that are like zoos, ladies and gentlemen, so I speak from experience. My friend Bill says anything worth having is worth working for, including school grades, and he's perfectly correct. When I put forth effort to achieve a thing, especially if it takes a lot of effort to achieve it, I have a great deal of pride in myself. My self-esteem blossoms like crazy. The idea that somehow or other school systems are supposed to promote self-esteem without any effort on the part of the self has baffled me for 25 years. You cannot give someone self-esteem like you could give them a piece of paper saying that you're wonderful. I'm sorry, that's not self-esteem. That's a greeting card. And no matter how much you want somebody to tell you you're wonderful, if you're working for a living, trying to pay your rent and your car payment and eat, your boss is going to expect a lot more from you than you standing there waiting for him to hand you a piece of paper telling you you're wonderful. There is not any way that I know of, ladies and gentlemen, outside of the Harry Potter novels, and even there, it couldn't be done, for me to wave my magic wand over the heads of a 12-year-old classroom and input knowledge without them having to do anything whatsoever, including listen. It cannot be done. And if those kids are not taught at home what they're supposed to do while they're in school, how on earth do people expect the teachers to do that as well as try to impart the knowledge they were hired to impart? If you have not been in a modern classroom, ladies and gentlemen, and I say modern with a shudder, and I'm only using that in its connotative meaning, not in its denotative meaning, not its connotative, modern in the sense as averse to historical. I've said this before, and I'll say it again. My job is to be in charge of the in-school suspension classroom. That means that students that I work with have committed an infraction of the rules. Their behavior has not been acceptable. They have done something against the school's policy or rules, etc., and they are being punished. It is a consequence for behavior that is not acceptable. My classroom rules are fairly strict. The students are not permitted to talk. They must raise their hand and wait to be called upon before they speak, ask a question, etc. They are permitted to ask a question or ask for help if they don't understand what they're doing. However, if they're doing a test or a quiz, they may not get help on the test or a quiz. Prior to starting it, however, they can have study time, and during study time, they can ask as many questions as they wish, provided they follow the rule of raising their hand and waiting to be called upon. They also may get a pass to the bathroom if they're ill. They may have a pass to go to the clinic, but they will work. If all of them complete their assigned work from their teachers and their behavior is good, then at the end of the day, they're allowed some free talk time, maximum 20 minutes or so. Now, that set of rules, ladies and gentlemen, is part of the punishment. Well, that set of rules, as my friend Linda said, was in every classroom when I was in school, because we were told that we were there to learn and listen to the teacher. It was not a social gathering. We were not there to discuss the latest fashions, who was dating whom, what was on television last night. And fortunately, we did not have cell phones and iPods and all of the other stuff that the kids have today. So those distractions weren't there, but we had others. Yeah. We had, I can remember boys with frogs in their pockets. I'm that old. But we did have a classroom that was a learning environment. And no, it was not one of those Victorian horrors as in Jane Eyre's school at Lowood, where everybody was smacked with a ruler and, wore uniforms so that they would be aware they were poor and all that other stuff. No. It was not a Victorian prison house for children. It was a school. It was a classroom. It was a place where we were expected to behave ourselves in a certain way so that we could learn. My friend Rod says, old, more mature, mature. Well, both of those, Rod. I am old, and yes, I am more mature. Hopefully more mature than I was yesterday, but no guarantees of that. But just the idea, ladies and gentlemen, of my classroom rules being considered punishment, I jokingly call my class the jail. And to the kids, it is. To them, my rules, which they know they must obey, because if they don't, I send them to the office, they're sent home, and they get a day of out-of-school suspension and can't make up the missing work. Now, some of them don't care. They'd much rather be suspended completely so they don't have to be in school. But those are the ones who aren't going to figure out that learning is important until they're maybe 20 or so, and can't find very many more people to live off of, rob, or sell drugs to. So, there's not a lot I can do about them. But not all of them are going to wind up like that. Sometimes I get really good kids, really bright kids, who are kids. They make bad decisions and poor choices, usually with the idea that it's going to make them look cool, or they just don't think, or they haven't paid attention to the school handbook, or, well, you can't do that to me, you know, I'm thus and so. And my friend Linda says those are the ones who are going to be in the cart that the rest of us are pulling, and she's right. Because the folks in the cart that the rest of us pull are the ones who are constantly voting for those who promise to give them softer cushions and better lunches in that cart while the rest of us pull them along and they can sit back and watch the scenery. And that is what our public education system is attempting to create, ladies and gentlemen. Because the concept of behaving well and putting forth an effort is considered to be cruel and mean and coercive and stifling of children's freedom. And because self-esteem is something that you can give somebody, but if you just write it on a piece of paper and send it home with them so their parents can see it. And the number of students I've seen go home with A's on their report card who simply cannot read anything above third grade level and they're in eighth grade would sicken most of you. And it does. I have a very good friend who's a special education teacher, and I love her dearly. She's a very kind, very sweet, wonderful woman. She lives her beliefs that one's job is to love one another. But unfortunately, she also buys into the idea that making sure that everybody gets an A is the right thing to do, because they'll feel bad if they don't. Or the teacher's past average will be insufficient for them to be retained. Now, I have been in classrooms, ladies and gentlemen, with poor teachers, both as a student myself, as a substitute, as an aide. But there, they were very few. I probably can count them on the fingers of one hand. And I've been doing this kind of work now in the public school system where I work for about counting, substituting, as well as working as an aide, about 10, 12 years now. And most of the teachers that I work with believe in a work ethic. They also are very passionate and in love with what they do. They teach because they were born to. They teach because the biggest thrill in their life is seeing the light bulb turn on above the head of a child who finally understands that 1/4 and 25% mean the same thing. These teachers are being handcuffed and gagged, ladies and gentlemen, by the proponents of evil measures like Common Core and the absurd socialist idea of redistribution of wealth, and that everybody deserves the same amount of success whether they actually are capable of doing anything or not. And I am sorry for those people who, for whatever reason, cannot do anything. Truly, I am. But I am also very angry that many of our children are being told that the world is going to accommodate to them. And the rude awakening that they are going to receive when they turn 18 and they are no longer protected by government from having to face the reality of supporting themselves. That makes me want to cry. Because I've worked with people and I've watched this happen. The students who, for whatever reason, are nursed through 12 years of school, taking home report cards with A's and B's when they are incapable, literally incapable of reading a newspaper or being able to fill out an employment application without assistance. Being told through grades and reports about how nice and wonderful they are until they get to be the magic age of 18 and the disability payments to their parents stop. As much as I may feel badly for students who have difficulties, I do not believe that telling them that those difficulties don't matter and we'll give you an A anyway is the way to go. Most of you who are regular listeners know that my husband was dyslexic. He was diagnosed when he was in second grade because he could no longer memorize all the stories in the reading book, which is what he'd done up through the first half of second grade. My David was born in 1947. So his learning disability was discovered in about 1954. Which was about the earliest that people really began to recognize dyslexia as an actual neurological disorder. Because, believe me, his parents tried glasses and everything else, and none of it worked. Well, when he was diagnosed, it was explained to them that he was wired backwards, which is the way the doctor put it. And, yeah, pretty much every faucet in my house, the line from the hot water is on the right side and the line from the cold water is on the left side, which is backwards, but that I'm used to it. I just know which knobs to turn. So, and I have hot water and cold water, so it never bothers me very much. But his parents never told him, oh, well, you can't help it, honey. We'll do the work for you and you'll get A's. Nope. They told him, this is going to be hard for you. You're going to have to work twice as hard as everybody else to get this. We will help you in every way we can. But you're going to have to work hard because this is hard for you to get. And you're not the only one who has to work hard because everybody has some subject or something that doesn't come easy. And he did work hard. And by the time he was in fifth grade, he was reading on grade level. Now, he never did master all of his times tables, but if there had been calculators when he was in college, he'd have been an engineer. But his work ethic and his parents' work ethic, their understanding and their teaching of him that, okay, this is harder for you than it is for everybody else, that doesn't mean the world is going to lie down, roll over, and show you its belly so you can scratch it and give you a great big kiss. It means you're going to have to work a little harder than everybody else if you really want to learn to do this. Well, he did. He wanted to learn to read, and he worked his delicate little derriere off to do it. My friend Bill said his daughter told him that school has changed since he was in school. And he asked, do they still have books? And she said, well, yeah. And then he said, it hasn't changed. Read the damn books. And he's exactly correct. But the problem is, in our modern schools, Bill, reading the book is very, very rare. The number of kids that I have through my classroom who can't even figure out how to find something in the table of contents of a textbook, let alone read the pages when they get there, would horrify you. And these are kids who have not been held back, and they aren't repeating grades. They literally cannot find anything in their textbook because they don't even know where to look. Many of them, once I explain to them, look for the index, find it, look for a keyword, No, don't look up the United States Constitution under T for the. Look under Constitution. They have gone away from understanding how to find something in a book, mainly because everything from the book is already pre-printed out on worksheets where all they have to do is fill in the blank, and the teacher says, open your book to page Kazornenplatz, read along with me, and fill in the blanks as we go. And it is directly from the textbook, and they do not have to read it. All they have to do is be able to find the place on the line and stick the word in a blank. And I've watched them do it. They also are so used to type in something on Google or Bing or Dogpile or any of the search engines, and then you'll get a bunch of stuff and print it out and copy and paste it in your report. They have no clue how to do research, none whatsoever, even on the internet, because half the time they can't read what they're pulling up. Technology is a wonderful thing. The access we all have to information and knowledge is literally mind-blowing, to use a phrase from my 1960s youth. Anything and everything is out there. We are inundated and drowning in information and opinion and ideas and suggestions and nudges and reports and commentary and blogs and texts and tweets and all of the rest of it. But our kids are not being taught that you have to think about what you're reading. Heck, they're not even being taught to read half the time. Or if they are, they're not doing it. Their ability to concentrate on something longer than a paragraph is minimal. You've heard me say before, when I assign them to read a story that is 6 pages long, I am, you know, the evil hortator on the Roman galley pounding my hammer as the slaves row the boat. I'm horribly evil and vicious and cruel, and I'm punishing them terribly, and they'll never be able to survive it, and I'm going to, you know, destroy them. They will just, you know, fall apart in a little tiny bit because it's so hard and it's too long. And yes, I've had kids almost burst into tears when they were assigned to read a 6-page story. My friend Rod said machines are a good aid, but when broken, you have to be able to do it yourself. And he's correct. Machines and technology make excellent servants, ladies and gentlemen, but extremely poor masters. And our children are being taught that they are the masters and not the servants. They're being taught that the only thing in life worth having is fun, that the only thing that matters is being cool, the only thing that matters is being accepted, the only thing that matters is your self-esteem. Well, my self-esteem was earned, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, many things in school came easily to me, for which I thank my maker. But many did not. And I had to work my delicate little derriere off to figure out long division, and I never really did get into higher mathematics because it bored me silly, and I wasn't willing to put forth the effort. But I certainly don't blame my teachers for that. They could have been magic and, you know, Professor McGonagall and, you know, Albus Dumbledore wrapped into one. And I still wouldn't have liked higher mathematics. And I probably wouldn't have taken it. And I didn't take it. I was satisfied with something they called senior math. And I can remember, as my friend talks about the old style adding machines, I had one in my job for years because my boss was my mother's age, and she didn't trust computers because she didn't understand them, and she didn't want anybody in her employ who understood something that she didn't. So that's why we didn't use computers. I had an electric typewriter for years in that job. And I remember when my dad got his first home computer, and he was going to teach me to, you know, do Fortran or something. And I was sitting there going, yeah, okay, no thanks. The whole technological revolution, as Bill Strong reminds us, pocket calculators didn't come around until 1977. Well, by 77, I had finished college and had been in the workforce for 8 years. So I didn't have the distractions. I had to do things with a pencil and paper. And long division was nearly my downfall. But I knew I had to know how to do these things. I knew because my parents taught me that my job as a child was to go to school and learn as much as I could. And that it wouldn't always be easy, and I might not always like things, but I still had to learn them. Because being an educated person was the primary goal. Because if you were an educated person, you had to have put forth the effort to get that education, which indicated to a potential employer that you had at least some knowledge of what it meant to have to work for something, and they'd be more likely to take a chance on you. When my husband worked for Best Products in the 1980s, he was concerned that he would lose his managerial position because the company was going through a reformation of not wanting to have anybody in management who didn't have at least a bachelor's degree, and David never finished his. So he was concerned that he'd lose his job. Well, he didn't, because he was extraordinarily good at what he did. He was a goldsmith, and basically headed up all of the jewelry repair shops nationwide that Best ran. But that was the thinking, that if you had put forth the effort to get all the way through college, then you were more likely to be able to sustain the effort of a management position, which had only what they called Chinese overtime, which meant that you really didn't get any. Below management, labor, got overtime if they worked more than 40 hours a week. If you were management, you were supposed to smile and say thank you when you work 60 for the same pay. You also understood, as I was taught and as my husband was taught, that sick leave was not a right, it was a privilege. So was vacation time. So was personal time. These were things that your employer gave you, not that you were entitled to. That's not the case. My friends are all discussing how old they are. And looks like all of them, oh, you're all kids. I've got you by, at least 8 or 9 years, children. So many kids. But that's okay. Remember, I work with kids all the time. One of the reasons I love you all so much. I haven't managed to survive as long as I have by being afraid to put forth effort for anything. Nor have I survived by expecting people to give me things. It always amazes me when somebody does give me something, because I was taught that if I wanted it, I had to go out and earn it somehow. And earning it didn't mean holding somebody else up at the point of a gun and taking it away from them so I could have it. But unfortunately, our kids do not understand this concept. I'm very fortunate in that I work in a rural area. And in my county, a lot of the kids are the children of people who have farmed for several generations. And most of them understand the idea of a work ethic because they're expected to put forth an effort. They're not the pampered little darlings run back and forth to soccer practice, this, that, and the other. They have chores. Because in order to keep a farm running, everybody has to pitch in. Not all people who live in my county are farmers. But many of them are. And a lot of the work ethic that we grew up with, those of us who are older than 40, is still alive and well and part of the culture in rural America. All you have to do is look at an election map from the 2012 elections and see where the votes for the current occupant of our house came from and where the votes against him came from. The heartland, as it's called. But that work ethic of the heartland, the idea that nothing is free, nobody is going to give you a handout unless you at least try to show that you're trying to get there on your own, and then they'll help you. A hand up, yes. A hand out, no. That's the way we were raised. But our children are not being taught that outside of our homes. And too many parents are products of what's been going on for the last 25 to 30 years in schools. And they are having children. And they are teaching their children the same thing that they were taught, that government owes them, that it's always somebody else's responsibility and never yours, that whatever mistakes you make are not your fault, it's because you are fill in the blank. You can fill it with anything. Skin color, religious affiliation, ethnicity, gender, whether you've got long fingernails or blonde hair or something of that nature. It's never your fault. It's always somebody else's fault. Always. Always, always, always somebody else's fault. It's never your fault. And that constant preaching, that constant indoctrination is having its effect, ladies and gentlemen. We see it in the fact that we are suffering under the second term of a president who believes that redistribution of wealth is not only possible, but it is a good thing to do. And he stated it flat out when he was campaigning. But because people are too blind to listen to what he says, they're so busy focusing on what color he is, and so terrified of being thought racist, that more and more and more and more, our wonderful public education system, and it has been wonderful for many, many, many years, is being undermined, subverted, and corrupted, and turned into crap. Please forgive me, that was an uncouth term to use, but it's the most telling one that I can think of. I don't know of any historical incidents of any society surviving when everybody was supposed to share equally, and no one was supposed to be better than anybody else. They tried it in Jamestown, for heaven's sake. They tried it in the early Christian era with the Collegia founded by St. Peter. It didn't work then, even among supposedly committed Christians who are ready to be martyred in Nero's Colosseum. What makes you think it's going to work now? It isn't. If we do not teach our kids, ladies and gentlemen, at home, what work ethic means, that when you want something, you must put forth an effort to get it, then we will be living in one of Mao's relocation and re-education camps before your children have children of their own. Uh, My friend Linda says that the people, which she calls the sheeple, which I understand, never really listen to the words of our current president, just the tone of his voice. And that's, of course, only when he's got his teleprompter, because when he doesn't have it, he doesn't seem to be able to give forth a complete thought coherently and concisely. And my friend Bill said, do kids do chores anymore? And yes, they do. My grandsons do, as far as I know. And many of the kids that I teach do. That's the advantage of living in a fairly rural community. Jefferson said that people would, that our people, our nation would fall if we packed each other, packed ourselves together in cities, as in Europe. And Jefferson was very much an agrarian. He believed in the virtues of farming and living on the land and putting back in what you took out and scientific methods of farming and that the you should be self-sufficient and so on and so forth. Of course, he did not have the technology that we do today, and our world is dependent upon it. But in general, he believed that when you piled people up in cities, they lost the connection with the things that Earth could teach them. And I don't mean the sentient planet Gaia. I mean the actual cycles of nature. Birth and death and growth and decay and the fact that, you know, you can't put your hand in the same river twice, in effect. Because people in cities, which is where the current progressive government gets their votes, ladies and gentlemen, live in a world where everything is somebody else's responsibility. Everything is compartmentalized. My responsibility is to sit at this desk and do this job, get in my cab or onto the subway, go home, either throw something in the microwave or take my children out to dinner or feed my husband or feed my kids from the takeout down the road, sit down, watch the news, go to bed, wake up in the morning, get on the subway, go to the office and do my job, and plan for my vacation to go to a beach or something so the kids can get a suntan. And I live in a condo, or I live in an apartment, or I live in a duplex, or I live in a suite or at a hotel or whatever, and I can't fix a faucet because if I do, the superintendent of the building will file a suit against me because he belongs to a union and he has to hire a union person to fix the faucet, because if he doesn't, then the cooperative building is not following the federal and state regulations and so on. In cities, everything is somebody else's responsibility. It pretty much has to be that way because you have millions of people in some cities living cheek by jowl, and if everybody tried to fix everything for themselves, the incompetent ones would probably blow up the cotton picking building, and everybody would be out. So the whole point of it is you're supposed to get an expert to do things, and that's that compartmentalization again. The idea that everybody has to learn to do one thing and do that really, really well. And if we just compartmentalize everybody into those nice, neat, progressive little boxes, all the children who should be bricklayers will be laying brick, and all the children who should be college professors will be lecturing on psychology, and all the children who should be doctors will be delivering babies and performing surgery, and all the children who should be garbage collectors will be standing in the dump raking through revolting stuff. This is progressive thinking. This is the way that Common Core, with its data mining, as my friend Linda reminds us, is going to make sure that we are all good, respectable, hardworking members of the ant colony, doing our job, being housed and fed and entertained by government so that we can produce whatever it is that we are determined to be good at, whether we want to or not. This is the kind of work ethic that progressives believe in. Because progressives do not believe in, or if they do, they're terrified of, individuality. Nothing frightens them more than a rampant individual. Because individuals don't give a rat's backside what the group thinks. Individuals care about what they think. And thus, they are a danger to progressive thought and progressive domination. The rebel, the iconoclast, the slightly strange, the nerd, the geek, the genius, the artist, the performer, anybody who is wise enough, strong enough, and cares about themselves enough to be an individual and be glad of it, must be coerced or threatened to become part of the group. Progressives do not want people to think. They want them to react. Progressive ideology, which has its roots in Fabian socialism, Marxism, some degree of fascism, the idea that somehow or other, going back to Plato and his philosopher kings, that human beings can be redesigned and re-educated to become happy, patient members of the great collective. And all of us will be happy and content because we will all have exactly the same things, which of course is what we all want. Well, actually, no, that's not what we all want. I do not want the newest iPhone. I don't enjoy the telephone. I prefer to speak with people face to face if I can. If I want to talk to someone, I like to see their facial expression, and I like it if they can see mine. I don't want a 54-inch flat-screen television. For one thing, I haven't got any place to put it, given the fact that all my walls are curved. It would be a little bit awkward trying to bend a 54-inch flat-screen to a curved wall, and I don't intend to try it. I do not want a Mercedes, a Lexus, or whatever. I do not want mink coats and jewels and so on. No, I don't want these things. But there are many people who do. I don't want a delicious plate of Brussels sprouts either because I don't like the taste of Brussels sprouts. But, oh, if government says that everybody has to have their daily serving of Brussels sprouts because they do incredible things for one's liver or one's intestines or something, the controlling, almighty, Agenda 21, father of all government will make sure that everybody gets their Brussels sprouts. And if you don't eat your Brussels sprouts, well, then there will be consequences. You won't get to go on the next sponsored outing to go look at water in an artificial beach so you can get the vitamin D from the artificial sun lamps at the artificial beach. Yeah, my friend Linda, Bloomberg, and to encourage a fit New York, is going to make sure that there's music in the staircases so that when you're climbing 14 floors, you'll at least have something pleasant to listen to over and above the pants, groans, and coughing when you try to get to the top. It's the progressive idea that somehow or other we can all obviously fall in love with the idea of everybody being alike. Because if everybody is alike, then everybody is equal. It's the old confusion between alike and equal, ladies and gentlemen, and our kids are being dumbed down so they will not understand the difference. We will be living in Kamazots. We will be the Borg. Now, those two references, one of them is television, the Borg, and the other is literature, A Wrinkle in Time by Madeleine L'Engle. If our kids cannot read, if our kids don't read, and they don't pay any attention to things that have been written from times that were similar to ours, they will fall into the Those who do not learn from history are doomed to repeat it. Trap. Because our major devil incarnate of the 20th century, Adolf Hitler, started out proposing exactly the same kinds of things that our current president and his minions are doing now. This is exactly the same agenda, ladies and gentlemen, of the National Socialist Party, otherwise known as the Nazis. Implications like women shouldn't be burdened with the care of their children from that revolting creature, Madame Pelosi. Children and caring for them are a burden. Okay, well, for me, they would be. But if everybody felt like me, the human race would have died out 20 years ago. Words have power. My friend Rod was saying, why do we use such nice-sounding words for communists and homosexuals? Progressive equals communist, gay equals homosexual. Basically, it's because we have become desperately afraid of offending anyone for any reason whatsoever. To offend someone is the ultimate sin in today's quote-unquote morality. To be offended by someone else's views or beliefs means in today's progressive part of society that the person who has offended you is an evil, bigoted, ignorant monster. If we are afraid to offend people, that is the quickest and most reliable method of making the First Amendment to the Constitution irrelevant. Because we no longer have freedom of speech. And freedom of speech means just that. It means that I am free to say offensive things. And if what I say is offensive to you, you certainly don't have to listen to me. I remember the whole Howard Stern frou-frou many years ago over the freedom of speech issues. Well, I don't like Howard Stern. I don't care for profanity. I don't like sexual innuendo. I find that type of discussion or attempts at humor off-putting. So I never listened to it. So it didn't offend me in the least because it was a product that I had a choice about. And if you have a choice here on Blog Talk Radio, those of you out there in the listening audience, if you're offended by things that I say, you've got a mouse or a computer, you can just sit there and click the close X in the top corner of your screen and you don't have to listen to me at all. And that's fine. Because if I'm listening to somebody and he or she is saying something that offends me, I can say so and I can walk away. Because I am an adult and because I have the power to make that choice. Unfortunately, our kids don't. And many of them in classrooms don't speak out. Because if they do, they can be accused of bullying and offending people and hurting people's feelings and damaging someone's self-esteem. Now, granted, most kids in school are just that. They're kids. The kinds of insults that we used to throw at each other generally were fairly childish and harmless. And we didn't, I remember the first time I used the term queer as a pejorative, and my parents explaining to me exactly what that meant, and I didn't know that, and I didn't. I had no idea. I I heard someone else use it to describe someone who I didn't like. So I just thought it meant unlikable. But, you know, it was not a part of my vocabulary because my parents didn't use terms like that. At least not in front of me. But the bad part, when we bend over backwards to avoid offense, not only do we lose our freedom of speech, but we are equating this offensiveness with bullying. And bullying is a very different thing, ladies and gentlemen. Bullying is intimidation. The use of force or the threat of force to force someone else, to intimidate them into giving you something you want or doing something you want them to do. And it is wrong to bully anybody. And my friend Rod says I was referring to a person rather than the practice. And yes, I was. Because to me, that term that I mentioned a few moments ago was not something that I understood the common use of. And I would not use that because I don't figure that other people's sexuality is my business, so long as they're not forcing it on me. I don't like pejorative terms, mainly because they usually indicate a level of ignorance. There are way more elegant ways of taking someone's skin off very slowly and very delicately that do not rely on four-letter words. And to me, it always seemed a waste of breath and effort because it just made the person using them look inarticulate. But there is a difference, ladies and gentlemen, between using profanity or discussing matters that some people find offensive or making a remark about someone that is libelous or slanderous, and bullying. Libel and slander, we have laws that punish. Libel, as you know, is printing something about a person that is incorrect, is false, that is damaging to that person's character or his ability to make a living or whatever. And slander is repeating such things, gossip, if you will. It's very difficult to prove slander unless you have a tape recorder on you all the time and you happen to be somewhere where you're listening to people talking about you behind your back. But I can remember growing up and, you know, we'd call each other names, but usually it was because we were angry at the other person because they took the seat we wanted on the swing set or pushed somebody in the playground or were hogging the bat in the pickup softball game. We didn't, or I didn't, grow up believing that it was right or correct or proper to assume that anybody was bad based on where they went to school, what color they were, what country their grandparents came from, what church they went to. I was not taught that kind of thing. I was taught that everybody was a potential friend. And you didn't decide they weren't unless they did something to you that indicated they weren't your friend. And that comes back, too, to the assumption that you're responsible for your own choices. I was always taught that if you're nice and polite and kind to people, they'll probably be nice and polite back to you. And if they aren't, you just don't have to hang around them anymore, which seemed to me to make excellent sense. Along with a basic work ethic, the idea that if I wanted something, I had to put forth something, some kind of effort to get it. In other words, if I wanted people to be nice to me, it probably would be better if I were nice to them first. Got a caller. Let's see who's on the line. Hello.
Good afternoon, Miss Terry. It's Lynn from California.
Hello, dear girl. How are you on this lovely Thursday
evening? Hanging in there,
Miss Linda.
Doing well, thanks. You know, it's funny when you talk about the pejorative, because especially if you're dealing with profanity or the four-letter words, the Anglo-Saxon, mm-hmm.
Yes, David, and then David used to sing a song called that when he played and sang in coffee houses in his misspent youth. And no, I won't go into it.
You know, and you're correct, because there are much more flowery ways to put someone down without using that. And like they say, I can't remember who said it, but they said, a diplomat can actually tell you to go to hell and make you look forward to the trip.
Exactly. Correct.
Yes. So there are ways. But when you talk about political correctness, I believe that was a very beginning back in the day, and I hated it back then. I thought, this is going to destroy this country, a stealth way at chipping away at the First Amendment. Because,
yes,
you know, there's no need for bullying, which is what the government does to us daily.
Yes.
That's putting it mildly. But, you know, as far as the PC stuff and stifling freedom of speech and freedom of thought and ideas, you don't have to, I believe Ben Franklin said, you don't have to protect polite speech in a polite society. It's ridiculous.
Correct.
So
exactly.
What they're stifling is the ideology of conservatism and Jeffersonianism and the Constitution. They're putting us on terror watch lists for these things. This is this is so Stalin, it scares the H out of me. I don't even know where to begin with it.
It's totally absurd, and it's totally insane because of, and what really drives me crazier than anything else is the complete inversion. Here the progressives are all about how they're treading this high moral ground about how wonderful they're going to make the world for all of us, and they're doing everything they can, and they do show that they despise every single human being on the planet.
Oh, sure.
Because
I mean,
because if you didn't despise them, you wouldn't feel you had to take control of their lives and redesign them.
Well,
so
well,
how is this, you know.
Right. The whole thing is it's upside down and crazy.
Of course.
And I said on my show yesterday that, you know, the people who are marching to their own demise, not the ones who are pulling the strings, but the ones who are ultimately going to be controlled, and the sheeple who actually buy into this stuff, you know, what I need to say to them is, look, if this is what you truly believe, and you really believe that these utopian things can be possible, I got news for you. I'll tell you what you do. You'll get on a plane and you go to North Korea and see what it's like. If you can get back there, you tell me what your utopian freedom looks like over there, because that's what you're advocating right now.
That is exactly correct.
If you don't know that, you better get into some books and figure it out. Because,
but
you know,
unfortunately, until and unless it happens to them, Linda,
I know.
People do not wake up until they're personally pinched on the butt. They really don't.
Well, yeah, and they're eyeball deep in merde.
Yes, that too. Well, even then,
if
getting to that point was gradual enough so they got accustomed to the smell, they won't notice that. But, you know, and that's basically what the media is attempting to get us to be accustomed to right now. But that pinch on the butt definitely will do it. It's amazing how good a teacher pain is, which was the reason for the caning and the whole bit, which I do not advocate, by the way.
Right. That's what Glenn Beck talked about today. He says, it's going to take the pain to wake anyone up. And he says, then there's going to be a reset, and God knows what, you know. So, but it's crazy what's going on.
It's
nuts. I think the reason I get adamant about these things is because I believe we're at the 11th hour. Some people are predicting September, October, that this financial meltdown's going to hit us, so we don't know. But, you know, everybody's going to have to prepare. That's why I hold my family close. I hold all my books, especially my history books and my pocket constitutions. They're, like, within reach.
Because
we're going to
need
it.
Pretty much the same way. Yeah, it's... It amazes me so much, Linda, that anybody with at least part of their brain functioning would be able to stomach 90% of the bucolic byproduct that emanates from the halls of Congress and the White House these days.
Yes.
Because that's exactly what it is. It is fertilizer, but unfortunately what they want to grow are poison plants with it, and they're in the process of creating the biggest crop I've ever seen.
Well, we exactly, because Look, I never went to college per se. I took a few courses, you know, here and there. And I was pretty much self-taught with anything that I wanted to learn because, thank God, I had parents who helped me learn how to read fluently by the time I was four. And there's no reason why an intelligent person cannot do that mm-hmm. with the right tutelage. And so I'm always praising God for, you know, giving me these two people that got me on the right track there.
Amen.
You know, I mean, and even though I had no college, I had enough book learning and enough book reading on my own to know mm-hmm. that when, you know, any progressive, whether it was Barry in the White House or on the campaign trail, spouting this stuff that very much came out of old Germany and very much came out of people like Stalin and Mao, the hair on the back of my neck stood up. I knew that this is what was going on. And then the more mm-hmm. I read, then, of course, then it really confirmed it. But, yeah, I mean, and this is the problem. They're just, even in my generation, completely void of knowledge of these things. And this is terrifying.
They are. Well, it has been going on for the past 30 years or so. I've watched it happen.
Oh, longer.
And
in my mother's day, because they
goes back to the
1930s. They gave them history books. Yeah, they gave the history books. My mom was born in 22. The horrible history books to those people, because she said, oh, it was so horrible, I didn't want to ever read history again. I said, that was by design. They didn't mm-hmm. want you to love history. I said,
yeah.
I said, because when she started reading the books I brought into this house in 2010, she looked at this stuff and she says, oh, my God, they never taught any of this to us. And that was the founding of our country. She knew none of this. They didn't teach her, even back then. My mom's 90 years old. So this is how far mm-hmm. back this dumbing down goes. And I was just lucky that I had my dad and other things going on, and libraries and stuff, you know. So,
well, what gives me hope, because I have to be an optimist, Linda. Otherwise, I just, you know, go out in the backyard, lie down, and wait for the weeds to cover me as I decompose. But
find some hemlock.
Yeah, that's it. But I'm not the only one with a functioning brain. I know that from the folks and the Patriot families and a lot of the other people who are out there blogging and talking on the internet and guesting on shows and so on and so forth. People who are standing up and telling the truth. And that belief in the immutable quality of the human spirit, yes, that we are created to be free and self-determining creatures. We are not ants, we are not bees, we are not drones, we are not Borg. We are individual human beings, and it is our individuality that will save us.
It's starting to bear fruit because of the things I've seen on the overpasses, which I attended yesterday, and what I heard mm-hmm. on the Hannity radio show was that his reception by these Marines was not anywhere near what he thought it was going to be, and that's really cool. They didn't actually mm-hmm. turn their backs on him because they would have been court-martialed. But they did not applaud. Oh, it was. They had to draw the applause out of these. It was fabulous. I'm going, finally.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, so it's starting to bear fruit. And you're right, because throughout history, look at the people like William Wallace and others who said, no, there's always going to be somebody that's going to help lead us out of this mess. And you know that. So thank God. It might be me. It might be Bill. It might be you. It might be Yola and Ron and the rest of us. You know, but... because we're not, we're about had it with these clowns. We're done. We're going to stand up for them.
Yep, and we are doing it in whatever way we can.
Thank you for doing a great show and taking my call and let you wind it up and all those things. And it was great to see all these people in the chat room today. You have a great evening.
Thank you, sweetie, for calling. You know you're always welcome. You take good care of yourself now, all right?
Okay,
can't afford to lose you.
I will. Thanks, love. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, honey. My friend Linda from California, there's a fighter, folks, a lady who truly believes that it is not only her job to be a good citizen, it is her duty to stand up and say what she believes to be true. And I salute her for it. This world needs lots more of Miss Linda. And I know that we do have many, many, many millions of people in this country who feel as you and I do, that this is us. We are this nation. And that our beliefs and our culture and our work ethic, our understanding that if we want it, we're going to have to work for it, is what will save us in the end. It has done so repeatedly in the past. And I believe in the things this nation stands for strongly enough that I believe it will happen again and is happening now. I'd like to thank all of the folks who are here with me in the chat room this evening and all of you out there listening. We've got a lot of shows available for you folks, and we do want you to come and visit our website, www.patriotfamilies, that's patriotfamilys.com. Visit us, join us, tell us what you think. What are your concerns? What can you see happening around you that makes you concerned about the future of your nation? What can you tell the rest of us to help us find a way to stop the degradation of the greatest nation in the history of mankind? And yes, we are. I have absolutely no trouble standing from the housetops and saying that. Because we are the greatest nation in mankind's history doesn't mean we're perfect, ladies and gentlemen, and it doesn't mean we can sit back on our fat little behinds and applaud ourselves and eat our ice cream and not put forth any effort to continue to make it the greatest nation. It should be a rallying cry. It should be not just the state of affairs, but the promise that we must live up to. Because what makes us the greatest nation is the people. That is this nation. It was founded on the principles stated in the Declaration of Independence and in the Constitution, that we are endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, and that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and that governments are instituted among men. They derive their just powers from the consent of the governed. And we have to understand and believe that those principles are real and alive. They are not outmoded things from musty documents over 200 years old. They are real. They are current. They are just as important now as they were in the 18th century and the 19th century and the 20th century. Because they mean something that is true and right and just. And it is up to us to support and defend them, especially when those we elect to high office will not. Thank you again for joining us this evening, folks. And I hope you'll join us for all our radio shows. And I'll be back again next Thursday evening at 6 p.m. here on Blog Talk Radio with another edition of Patriot Education. Between now and then, do everything you can to investigate what's happening in your local schools. Go to your school board meetings. Pay attention to your PTA meetings. If you have children in school, show up for those meetings with the teachers and listen. Listen to what they tell you. And teachers out there, don't give up. We need you because you will carry the torch. And as always, all my love to my greatest fan. Good night, everybody. Have a wonderful week, and I'll see you next Thursday at 6 p.m. Blessing be.
Blog Talk Radio and Patriot Family is where you need to be if you want to be informed and inspired 5 days a week. On Monday at 7:30 p.m., you can listen to the Constitution Hour. On Tuesday at 7 p.m., you can listen to Patriot Family Chat. On Wednesday at 7 p.m., you can listen to Right from the Left Coast. On Thursday at 6 p.m., you can listen to Patriot Education. And on Friday at 7 p.m., you can listen to Exposed but Never Forgotten. All times are Eastern Standard Time. Hope to see you there.